Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. There is no doubt that Hamas in the Gaza Strip is by far the most successful anti-Semitic entity in the world today. Beyond all competition, it has mobilized Jew hatred around the world, using the State of Israel both as its target and its primary weapon. By waging war against Israel for quite a few years already, Hamas has inspired and energized international organizations such as the United Nations and the European Union, governments and parliaments in Europe, the Western media, human rights groups, businesses, and large sectors of the population, the general population, particularly in Europe and the United States, to turn against Israel. Some do it out of malevolence, some out of ignorance, I think mostly out of ignorance, and others blindly jumping on the virtue signaling woke bandwagon. That's what people do today. As a result of all this, the global scope and scale of Hamas's anti-Semitic influence exceeds even the Nazis, although it does take a lot of its own inspiration from the Nazis. The foundation of Hamas's success lie in the Soviet Union. A little history I'd like the listeners to hear. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, when Israel was aligned with the West rather than with Russia, it wasn't called Russia then, it was Union USSR, Israel was aligned with the United States. The Soviet leadership decided to undermine American and British influence in the Middle East by fomenting a war of national liberation against Israel. Russia invented a Palestinian national identity in order to turn a really religious malice against Israel. It's a struggle over land. It's a cause that correctly understood to gain much more greater traction and support in the West than simply a religious war. They turned it into a national war. That was sell better in the West. That developed into the most successful campaign in history, giving rise to accusations of land theft, unlawful occupation, illegal settlement, apartheid, and all these other lies. They are now accepted as facts by so many around the world, particularly in the West. Decades of this anti-Israel propaganda have taken to a dangerous position we are in today. That means whatever is done against Israel and against Jews is justified as legitimate resistance. Any action taken by Israel to defend itself is unjustified and unacceptable to these people. So, like so much else in the world today, facts and reality simply don't matter. If the Palestinians are considered to be oppressed, if they're doing anything about the oppression, it's justified and understandable to the rest of the world. If Israel, which is the oppressor, is doing anything, it's intolerable and wrong. Ever since Israel attempted a two-state solution back in 2005, they pulled every soldier out of Gaza. They uprooted every last Jew from the territory. Since then, Hamas has used all its energy to intensify and expand this global anti-Zionist paradigm. Hamas has always known it does not have the military power to achieve its objective of eradicating Israel. Instead, it has weaponized Israeli self-defense to its own advantage, which is rather clever. Every attack against Israel has been designed with the overriding purpose of forcing Israel to react militarily. It's deployed its weapons, its ammunition, communications, fighters, and places where Israel would have to kill innocent civilians in order to protect its own population from them. Despite the measures the Israeli army has taken to minimize collateral damage, added value is gained by positioning terrorist infrastructure locations protected under international humanitarian law, like schools or hospitals or mosques. That is what the terrorists do, and they do it quite cleverly. The truth of the matter is, Hamas's aim, among others, is to maximize Gaza civilian deaths, especially of women and children, in order to provide accusations of war crimes and crimes against humanity up to Israel. They want to delegitimize Israel and isolate Israel from the international community. This plan comes together all the time, and Israel's necessary defensive action, and Israel keeps to the laws of armed conflict. Israel is always, action is accompanied and followed up with outright condemnation, the UN Human Rights Council, and human rights groups and other hostile governments. No. And the more this cycle of violence goes on, the more these denunciations of Israel embolden and encourage Hamas to keep attacking. These Hamas-provided condemnations of Israel are amplified in the media and on college campuses by the BDS movement and the like. There are armies of useful idiots that follow Hamas's depraved agenda. The objective of these groups is not so much to damage Israel directly, but more to intimidate Jews in the diaspora. They seek to bully the strongest backers of Israel internationally and to force them to either abandon their support of Israel or directly turn against Israel. Those who succumb to such manipulation do so to avoid intimidation and to gain social acceptance in an environment where Jew hatred posing as anti-Zionism is increasingly fashionable. It is particularly effective at the campuses of universities, where the student targets lack of intellectual maturity, lack of experience, and a very shallow depth of knowledge, and where lifelong standpoints often take root. All this has been well documented that the level of Jew hatred is multiplied when Jewish anti-Israel organizations, and there are Jewish anti-Israel organizations, they are present on campus, and there are more and more Jewish anti-Israel organizations on campus in the United States. Politicians are also acceptable to anti-Zionist hate campaigns, especially when large numbers of Muslims are among their voters. We can see this happening now in places like Michigan and Illinois, which have a very large number of Muslim voters. So President Biden, who 6 months ago was tremendously supportive of Israel, is starting to back off. Even those leaders, political leaders, who support Israel will seek to appease their anti-Israel voters because they want their vote, particularly in the election coming up in November. For in this war, for example, likes of U.S. President Joe Biden and U.K. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak have repeatedly called on Israel to observe the laws of war and to avoid killing civilians, although they know that Israel already does so. They say this over and over again, despite knowing full well that Israel already does exactly that. It observes the laws of war. This is especially dangerous because their words imply that Israel is in fact carrying out war crimes, and they incite even greater Jew hatred. Thus, Hamas and its supporters are carefully orchestrated campaign, stroke anti-Semitism around the world, and feed off its effects. Terminating Hamas in Gaza, and actually terminating Hamas everywhere in the world, will have a major impact. For as long as the succession to the terrorist group is not allowed to take hold there, Israel will be safer. Although Hamas today is anti-Semitism, they are really the brand leader of anti-Semitism. It's far, of course, the only major player. For its leading competitors, you don't have to look any further than Judea and Samaria, and indeed to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Islamic Republic of Iran controls much of what is happening and being done by Hamas. The current conflict has caused a profound spike in Jew hatred in the West, in Europe, in the United States, and even in South America. And there's no doubt that after the war, the steady state level anti-Semitism will settle again, but it will be much higher. There will be much more anti-Semitism after this war is over than it was before the war began 6 months ago. This would be this really should be of tremendous importance and concern to the governments in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere, because the Jews in those countries are facing a new growth of anti-Semitism. It's the responsibility of these governments to suppress anti-Semitic hatred by defending the Jews or shutting down those groups that are responsible and take a much harder line against the main offenders. Who are the main offenders? UN bodies in New York and Geneva. Governments should be working to actively counter anti-Israel propaganda, and they should be telling the truth about Israel rather than turning a blind eye or even fueling it, as they often do, even inadvertently. You know, they're supporting Ukraine in its resistance to Russian aggression. Most people don't know anything. They know very little about the Ukraine. They don't know what kind of government there is in Ukraine, whether it's dictatorship or a democracy. People really in the United States, for example, people around the world, but particularly in the United States, know absolutely nothing about Ukraine. You ask 1,000 people what they know about Ukraine, you'll get very poor answers. But they support Ukraine because Ukraine is against the Soviet Union, and these people are against the Soviet Union. So we should apply the same approach to, in order to persuade the electorates of the need to support the Israel, thus as they're convincing their people to support Ukraine, although people know very little about Ukraine. Anyway, what has happened is, essentially, in what I've spoken so far, is that Hamas has essentially weaponized anti-Zionism, and it's very effective around the world, particularly today in the United States, to my sorrow, and in Europe. And is starting to also pick up in South America. So Hamas has done a very good job around the world, even while we are beating them in Gaza itself. These seem to be the facts on the ground. Incidentally, I might add the following. Anti-Semitic incidents have surged by almost 400% in the United States and about 140% in Canada, and a record high in the United Kingdom and in the European Union. From violent threats and physical intimidation on public transit to widespread vandalism of Jewish-owned businesses, Jews are no longer safe in many places or even countries where they felt safe before. The media's fixation on anti-Semitism in the West makes sense given the Jewish diasporas concentrated in Western Europe and Anglo-America. But Jews do not only live in those countries, they also live in Latin America. For a Jew living in Argentina or Chile or Mexico, a story condemning, for example, an anti-Semitic attack in Canada will only do so much. Stamping out anti-Semitism across the globe means stamping out anti-Semitism everywhere, and Latin America should be included. Latin America has long nurtured an anti-Semitic underbelly that it has gotten very little attention from the media. Latin America is home to approximately 500,000 Jews, including nearly 200,000 in Argentina. In Brazil, anti-Semitic attacks have risen nearly 1,000% since October. In Peru, right-wing extremists target Peruvian Jewish journalists and things like that. In Nicaragua, Jewish centers have been vandalized, and Mexico's former president, who has Jewish parents, is being accused of being a Jew and a foreigner. The Argentina's new president claims to be an ally of the Jewish people, and he appointed Rodolfo Barra to be the country's police prosecutor. Barra belonged to a right-wing group responsible for hundreds of anti-Semitic attacks against synagogues, a violent riot in a Jewish neighborhood, and a murder of a Jewish lawyer. He will now be responsible for prosecuting anti-Semitism in Argentina. Political leaders in nearly every Latin American country talk about Jewish control of the media, politics, the all kind of anti-Semitism in leadership positions in South America. So it is a very serious problem. Iran funds operations against Jews in Israel, and the last 5 years has signed multiple security deals with Latin American governments. It's a tough situation because anti-Semitism is becoming more rabid in South America. Like the Colombian president compared Israel to Nazis, and the dictator of Venezuela frequently goes on tirades against Jews. So we have a serious problem, and hopefully the Jewish Agency and other American organizations will do something about it. I certainly don't know what should be done, but it is a developing problem. Anti-Semitism in Latin America won't go away overnight, but in order to fight it, one has to recognize it. I'll be back after the break.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel? Shalom, I'm Natalie Sapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home.
every Sunday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I'm recording this segment of the program on the morning of Sunday, the 14th of April. And the reason I say this is because I want to record this now because of something that happened this morning. Rocket warning sirens blared across northern and southern Israel, as well in Jerusalem and towns in Samaria. Interestingly enough, and it's sort of funny. I'm hard of hearing, and I didn't hear the blast, nor did my wife. So when I got up this morning, I was surprised to get a telephone call from several of my children and grandchildren asking if I was okay, because they themselves had to go into shelters during the early hours of the morning. And Israeli Defense Forces called on residents of the Golan Heights in the north and Dimona, Elat, and the Nevatim areas in the south to stay near bomb shelters until further notice. An Israeli defense official told Army Radio that more than 100 drones had already been intercepted outside of Israeli airspace. The official said that that these drones were shot down by the United States and the United Kingdom. The Israeli Air Force was tracking additional UAVs and watching for additional waves of attacks. The Iranian official news agency reported that ballistic missiles were among the projectiles fired at Israel. The Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen also launched an unknown number of drones at the Jewish state. And an IDF spokesman said the military had prepared for this kind of scenario and was ready to intercept the incoming projectiles. He noted, however, that Israel's early defense systems were hermetic. The Israeli Airports Authority announced the country's airspace would be closed from 12:30 a.m. Right now, while I am recording the program, the international airport, the only one we have in Israel, in Lod, is closed. In a video address to the nation, the prime minister said the country is ready to defend itself and go on the attack. In his speech, he said, "Citizens of Israel, in recent years, and especially in recent weeks, Israel has been preparing for a direct attack by Iran. The state of Israel is strong, the IDF is strong, the public is strong." And also the premier thanked the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and other countries for their support in the face of Iranian aggression. And he said, "We have determined a clear principle. Whoever harms us, we will harm them. We will defend ourselves against any threat. We'll do so level-headedly and with determination." He also said, "Citizens of Israel, I know that you're also level-headed. I call on you to follow the directives of the IDF, the Home Front Command. Together we will stand, and with God's help, together we will overcome all our enemies." The Defense Minister of Israel, Yoav Gallant, has said that in recent days we've strengthened our defensive and offensive array. We have determined to take any measures required to defend the citizens of Israel. So actually, I am speaking to you now from what has become a war zone, something Israel sort of been under attack all the time, but not always active attack. And so I felt the need to broadcast at this moment the way, interestingly enough, by the way, things in Jerusalem at the moment, and I'm recording this at around noontime, a little after noontime on Monday the 14th, as calm as could be. So it turns out we're in a war, but we don't feel it because, thank God, our defensive systems are doing very, very well. So I just felt that the need to start recording this part of the program because, in a sense, I'm in a war zone right now. Truth of the matter is, Israel's always a war zone, but today it's a hot war zone. And I don't feel it, but it seems that this is the actuality of what's happening right now. I want to say a few words about the fact that a lot of people are talking about a two-state solution. We've been hearing that since 1948. You can ask yourself a question. How can Israelis, Jews, believe that the recognition of a Palestinian state by the United States and other countries like France and Spain and Ireland and Great Britain and so on, how can they think that this will bring peace? These countries have no means of enforcing any commitments undertaken by a state of Palestine and a potential peace treaty, and even less will to do so. Can anyone believe that giving more power, even short of sovereignty, to a revitalized Palestinian Authority will not lead to more war? Israel will still have to protect its security, both during and after any transition. So these cries of occupation will persist. You have to remember that these cries of occupation came into even wider use after Israel completely withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005 with not one Jew left in sight. Recognition of Palestine as a state, even if it were supposedly demilitarized, would enable it to enter into military alliances and defense agreements with whomever they choose. It could be China, could be Russia, could be Iran, any or all of them. Why would such a state not be used as a base? In the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization 1974 10-point plan of phases, they would do things a little bit at a time and eventually take all of Israel. Why would such a state not open the gates of its undefined territory to all so-called diaspora of 14 million Palestinians, Muslims, and others who would like to join the fight against Israel? And alarmingly, the U.S. has reportedly asked Qatar, which is Hamas's main patron since 2007, the U.S. has reportedly asked Qatar to operate a supposedly temporary pier in Gaza right now, as being planned to deliver supposedly humanitarian aid. Apart from evidence that Hamas is stealing the humanitarian aid and other hoarding or selling it to Gazans or the black market at a prices few can afford, one has to ask, what else will come in with humanitarian aid? With Qatar in charge, demilitarization will likely last less than a week. Those who want to recognize or impose a Palestinian state, knowingly or unconsciously, aim at Israel's destruction. Peace will come when Jews and the Americans and the Europeans support those fighting to preserve civilization, not to preserve terrorism. Curiously, like President Joe Biden, as top security officials, the former ambassador Martin Indyk ignores a crucial element. Radical Islam does not tolerate the existence of a sovereign non-Islamic entity like Israel on land that was once conquered by Muslims. It is called Dar al-Islam, the abode of Islam. As most Palestinians have been credibly straightforward about, there is no place for an Israeli state. Also, by the way, I have to repeat this every now and then to remind the listeners and myself that tangible land for an intangible peace and billions of dollars will not change anything. Just buy them bigger weapons. The only thing that could change them is re-education. So the Palestinian people, by the way, and I want to quote somebody, his name is Zohair Mohsen, the PLO official, on March 31st, 1977, said the following: the Palestinian people does not exist. The creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against the state of Israel, for our Arab unity. In reality today, there is no difference between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. Only for political and tactical reasons do we speak today about the existence of a Palestinian people. Since Arab national interests demand that we posit the existence of a distinct Palestinian people in order to oppose Zionism. How can Israel possibly believe that the recognition of a Palestinian state by the United States and other countries will bring peace? These countries have no means of supporting Israel. Recognition of Palestine as a state, even if we're supposedly demilitarized, would enable it to enter, as I said a moment ago, all kinds of defense agreements with other countries. So, again, those who want to recognize or impose a Palestinian state knowingly aim at Israel's destruction. And that is the way it is there. By the way, it's about a month ago, or no, about 2 weeks ago, Martin Indyk, who was U.S. Ambassador to Israel twice, wrote the following in Foreign Affairs: the allegedly dead two-state solution resurrected by U.S. President Biden and his top national security officials is the only way to create lasting peace among the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Arab countries in the Middle East. Question you have to ask yourself is, how could an unimaginable war bring about only unimaginable peace? Curiously, Joe Biden and his top national security officials, just like them, the former ambassador, Martin Indyk, ignores a real crucial element. Radical Islam does not tolerate the existence of a sovereign non-Islamic entity and a land that once belonged to them. Palestinian Islamists and the Islamic Republic of Iran are engaged in a jihadist, religious, nationalist, military, territorial, diplomatic conflict with Israel's Jews, however much the West may refuse to see it. They fight against the Jews to prove the Quran's divine promise to the Jews. And in the Quran, for example, it says, O my people, enter the Holy Land which God has prescribed you, and turn not your back to turn about losers. We said to the children of Israel, dwell in the land, and when the promise of the world comes to pass, we will bring you a rabble. Land for peace and billions of dollars will not change Islam. The Quran says, fight those who believe not in God and those who have been given the book until they pay their tribute out of hand. When Back in September 2011, the UN Security Council examined the application of Palestine. The Palestinians put in an application to join the UN. One of the criteria is that only peace-loving states willing to accept obligations of the UN Charter who are able and enact the UN Charter can be members. You have to be a peace-loving nation. So, it's interesting, by the way, a PLO executive committee member named Zuhair Mosen stated in an interview with a Dutch newspaper, he said, the creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against Israel. For tactical reasons, Jordan, which is a sovereign state with defined borders, cannot raise claims to Haifa and Jaffa, while as a Palestinian, we can undoubtedly demand Haifa, Jaffa, Beersheba, and Jerusalem. However, the moment we reclaim our right to all of Palestine, we will not wait even a minute to unite Palestine and Jordan. The Palestinians are Arabs. Their leaders seek to destroy the Jewish state. They would have a hard time renouncing their aim of displacing Israel or of changing an education of hatred and accepting the obligations contained in the Charter of the United Nations. Anybody who did so would be called a traitor. And by the way, because he did so, the Egyptian president, Anwar Sadat, signed a peace agreement with Israel, and he was assassinated for doing so. Can the U.S. and European states recognize Palestine as a peace-loving state while its government, the Palestinian Authority, continues to finance terrorism by paying salaries to imprisoned terrorists and their families with U.S. funds in violation of the Taylor Force Act, which the U.S. became the law of the land? Palestine is not able to be a peace-loving entity. These are the facts on the ground. And the interesting, just one more thing on this in this section. The original Palestinian Charter says Palestine, it's written in Arabic, but the English translation is Palestine, with the boundaries it had during the British Mandate, is an indivisible territorial entity. The Palestinian people have a right to it. Armed struggle is the only way to liberate Palestine. Commando action constitutes the nucleus of Palestinian popular liberation. So how does this show that the Palestinian Authority is capable of living in peace with the Jewish people? By the way, I spoke about in the last few minutes is something I've said spoken about before, and I'm sure the listeners have heard it over and over again. But the truth of the matter is that it has to be repeated once in a while. So we will have to remember, beside all the words and the diplomacy and all the things you hear, the bottom line is that the leaders at least of the Palestinians and the educators in the Palestinians simply do not agree to the existence of the State of Israel and will do everything they can to destroy it. We have to keep this in mind all the time because this is the nature of our enemy. I'll be back after the break.
Be smart. Listen to Israel News Talk Radio in the background while you work and get the latest news and commentary from Israel. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I'm going to quote heavily from an editorial that appeared in the Jerusalem Post on Monday, April 15th. The day after the attack upon Israel from Iran. I'm going to quote from it because it says pretty much what I would have liked to say, but they say it better. And I want the listeners to hear this. Historic is one of the many words that can be used to describe the very early morning hours of April 14th, which was yesterday. A shadow was brought into the light, and decades in the making has the potential to flip the Middle East on its axis. There is no question that Israel must respond to the attack upon it. The question is when, how, where, and what kind of backing will Jerusalem get when that happens? These are the weighty considerations that the government and its leaders face. Iran's missile barrage was unprecedented, both in its direct nature, in its quantity and tonnage of TNT. It could have been a catastrophe. The very impressive intercept rate, along with the mind-boggling cooperation of anti-extremism states and Israel, deserves a moment of reflection and pride. As a matter of fact, what happened that night was something unprecedented, really. And it's shocking, and it's sort of encouraging to see the cooperation that other nations have had with Israel, because they're against a common enemy, Iran. A 99% intercept success rate is incredible. And the fact that many missiles and drones were shot down outside Israeli airspace helped to save lives. Although one girl was severely hurt and is indeed now fighting for her life, and some material damage was sustained, but it really was very, very small because the intercept success rate was unbelievable. In some ways, the highly successful intercept rate managed to downplay some of the damage, diplomatic and military, sustained since October 7th. We are proud and grateful to our allies for standing with us at this moment of emergency. If there was any doubt if the criticism of Israel's behavior in Gaza would take away support against its attempt at the annihilation of our enemy in Gaza, that worry was laid to rest because the U.S., the United Kingdom, France, and others lending their aid and support. These are not mutually exclusive, and calls are still being made to cut down the Gaza war. But when push comes to shove, our allies supported us, particularly the West and the anti-extremist Arab world. So that was really good. It was pragmatic. This divide was made clear when President Biden on Sunday, as reported in the New York Times, that alongside Biden's support of Israel is a hope that a larger escalation will be avoided by Israel. The question is, will Israel go on the offensive? The report in the Times said they considered Israel's interception of the more than 300 drones and missiles to be a significant strategic victory that may not require further retaliation. Right now, at the moment that I'm making this broadcast, and I'm recording this on Monday, And this program won't be actually go on the air until the end of the week. A lot could happen. So what I'm saying now is as of this moment. So we don't know what's going to happen. Israel has wiggle room, but in the meantime, Israel has global support. Biden was clear that the United States would not participate in or maintain any Israeli action against Iran. It wouldn't approve of any action that Israel takes against Iran. As a sovereign state, Israel has a choice, but that's not the question. Israel could launch 300 missiles at Iran like Iran did at Israel. Question is, should it? That is a question facing our government at this moment on Monday morning. We have to weigh the cost and benefit of attacking Iran. Israel needs the Americans. That's clear. U.S. National Security Council, fellow's name is John Kirby, told ABC that the U.S. will continue to help Israel defend itself, but it did not want war with Iran. He said the commitment of the United States is ironclad to defend Israel and help Israel defend itself. We do not seek a wider war with Iran. We don't seek escalated tensions in this region. That was said by the Americans. So our government at this moment is weighing what to do. First, to get back at Iran for what they did, to prevent Iran from doing it again, at the same time, not to in any way affect our relations with the United States. Israel needs a proper strategy. At the moment, Israel has the time, and now is the time not to be rash. It is time to be strategic and smart. No one should forget we are in the middle of a war at the moment in Gaza. By the way, on Saturday night, 2 days ago, Hamas rejected the hostage deal plan, leaving at this moment 133 captives in Gaza. And our minister, Benny Gantz, said the following: Iran is a global problem. It's a challenge. It's a danger to Israel. And yesterday, this attack upon Israel, the world took a clear stance with Israel against this danger. The result is Israel and the world against Iran. This is a strategic victory that we must use to build the time to build up our security. But the fight isn't over. This is precisely the time to strengthen the strategic alliances that we have and the regional cooperation that we've built, and they stand the test of time. Israel proved that it is an anchor of military and technological power, of security in the Middle East, all thanks to the Israel Defense Forces. We will build a local coalition against Iran, an exact punishment from Iran, in the place and at the time that is correct for us. In other words, everybody knows that Israel is going to react to what happened. Israel really has no choice. When Iran sends 300 missiles against Israel, Israel must respond. The question is, when and how. And we have the time to think this through so that we do this in the best way, not only to get back at Iran, but not to lose the cooperation of our allies. This is a very tough moment for the state of Israel. We know what we have to do, but the question is how and when. So that's the situation at this moment. This is a critical moment in the history of Israel. Israel signed the Abraham Accords, and it was a surprise to most of the world. Although Israel had opened an international diplomatic office in the United Arab Emirates as far back as 2015, and the worst kept secret in the Middle East for years was Israel's security cooperation with Arab Gulf countries. But there's a difference between secret cooperation and openly signed agreements. Back in 2020, Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu, American President Trump, and the foreign ministers of the UAR and Bahrain signed a normalization accord on the White House lawn. The fact that Israel was accepted by Arab countries and hoped that it would mark the beginning of the end of the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's interesting that it's pretty much agreed that the United Arab Emirates wouldn't sign an accord with Israel without Saudi Arabia's approval. This put Israel one step closer to signing a normalization deal with Saudi Arabia. Apparently, Israel's been dealing secretly with Saudi Arabia on security issues. So, one of the good things about the Abraham Accords, it took off the problem that the Arab nations were upset about what's happening between Israel and the Palestinians. It kept back normalization with Arab countries. All too often, Israel heard that it would never be able to normalize relationships with Arab countries until the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was resolved. So, what was the problem? The Palestinians refused to make the compromises necessary to make a deal. They have spent decades turning down whatever Israel offered. As long as the Palestinians attacked Israel through terrorism and refused to compromise for peace, Israel couldn't move forward on signing accords with the Arab world. But the Abraham Accords was the first time Arab countries were prepared, normalized with Israel without concern for what was happening with the Palestinians. The Palestinians were no longer part of the picture. Now, not everyone was excited about the Abraham Accords. Palestinians and those who support the Palestinians challenged Israel and by asking what was achieved by the Accords. What they said was something that sort of makes sense. They said that Israel was never at war with the UAE, never at war with Bahrain, and never at war with Moscow or the Sudan. They argued, the Palestinians and their supporters argued, that these agreements were mostly for show and didn't help Israel or the region at all. So the Palestinians argued against the Abraham Accords. But the truth of the matter is, it was really something. It's important to note that the goal of the Abraham Accords wasn't to make Israel safer from the threat of Palestinian terrorism, but it from Iranian nuclear aggression. reasoning that the Abraham Accord should have solved all of Israel's security issues, and then calling them the failure when they didn't solve the problem with the Palestinians doesn't make sense. The Abraham Accords were signed to strengthen the global coalition opposing Iran and opening up new avenues of trade and cooperation in these areas. The truth of the matter is that the Palestinians are an issue unto themselves, really separate from the Arab and the Muslim world. Palestinians have used terror against the Jews long before 1948, going back to riots in 1834. Terrorism and violence has been the traditional Palestinian reaction to Jews. And later on in their development, their reaction to Zionism and the reaction to the State of Israel. So what happened on October 7th, the terrible attacks by the Hamas and the Palestinians, was precipitated by a Palestinian culture of hate and violence against Jews. In a sense, that has nothing to do with the other Arab and Muslim countries. Obviously, we'll try to make some kind of peace with all our neighbors. The Palestinians and their supporters should ask why some Arab countries do make peace with Israel, while the Palestinian response for over 100 years has been terror and hate. That's all they've done. The international communities is looking for a restart at the end of the war in Gaza. The war in Gaza will eventually end. What really is needed, a change in the Palestinian approach to Israel. At the moment, the Palestinian approach to Israel is rejection and terrorism against Israel and against Jews. If they ever learn to accept peace with Israel, the whole situation will be different. In other words, the other Arab and Muslim countries realize that normalcy with Israel takes much more precedence than their support of the Palestinians. The Palestinians, in a sense, are a hindrance to real support and cooperation in the Middle East, particularly against a common threat, which is Iran. So the Palestinians really need a new leadership, because Israel wants to go ahead with its plans to become a really integral part of this region. And interestingly enough, it's the common fear of Iran that's bringing other Muslim and Arab countries together with Israel. So, you know, if someone would have predicted all of this 10 years ago, they wouldn't have imagined what the situation we have today. A common enemy, Iran, is bringing all our neighbors into closer cooperation with Israel. And that is something that could have been predicted, but it is a reality today. I'll be back after the break.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. The attack on Israel last week by Iran should be perceived what it really is. It's essentially a declaration of war. This is the first time since 1991 that a foreign country directly attacked Israel. We've been fighting all kind of terrorists for years, but it wasn't, and it's more than 30 years that it, since a foreign country directly attacked Israel. The attack was done on a very large scale, and Israel has faced and countered this attack. There were hundreds of UAVs and ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. There was a unique challenge in Israel's history. So apparently this attack by Iran signifies a shift in Iran's security policy and perception. Since the revolution there back in 1979, which is known, by the way, as the Islamic Revolution, Iran has maintained a careful approach because it really didn't want to get in trouble with the United States or with Israel, because there is huge difference in the ability of the various parties to attack each other. Israel and the United States, together or separately, are much stronger than Iran. So what Iran was doing all these years, their strategy involves establishing, arming, training, and financing proxies all across the Middle East in order to encircle Israel. So this was supposed to essentially serve as a deterrent against potential attacks on its program. It has a military nuclear program underway in Iran, and it didn't want to be attacked either by Jerusalem or by Washington, so they've been using proxies. That's what's been happening. Now, and in recent years, this is more or less they've increased their militariness. This is evident because they've attacked Saudi Arabian oil installation, and there are apparently some other things that indicate that they're becoming more militant openly. So it's interesting that the air defense operation that successfully intercepted Iran's air assault against Israel, 99% of the over 300 missiles and UAVs launched by Iran were shot down by an international coalition led by the United States. And Israel, thank God, came out pretty well, unscathed. However, the failed paradigms that led to that assault on October 7th have taught us that Israel and its allies must not revert to a defensive posture only. They must demonstrate quite clearly to Iran and to the rest of the Middle East also, that there is a price to be paid for launching attacks, even if they are deflected. They must pay a price for launching attacks. Before October 7th, the dominant security attitude in Israel was one that relied primarily on defense, because Israel has become pretty adept at shooting down rockets from the Gaza Strip. Israel is using what's called the Iron Dome system. So even though the arsenal in Gaza got much more sophisticated, and also in Israel's northern border, Hamas is in Gaza, but in Israel's northern border, Hezbollah was provided with boosters by Iran, so we're being attacked on two fronts. As long as damage to Israel's home front could be minimized, Israel could make do with limited strikes on the terrorist organizations that surround us. Now, both the military and the political echelons in Israel had this idea. It was an idea of defense. This is also apparently agreed upon by the United States, which provided billions of dollars in support of Israeli air defense. There was a 2018 U.S.-Israel Memorandum of Understanding, and it was agreed upon that America would assist Israel in defending itself. And in 2022, Congress approved an additional $1 billion for this thing called Iron Dome. So Israel has been essentially in a defensive position the whole time. It saved a lot of lives, and Israel is obviously grateful to the United States. So the problem is that Israel was always thinking in terms of defense. Jerusalem believed, the government in Israel believed, that the proper response to Iran's efforts to build a ring of terror around Israel through its proxies was to, our response was to build a defensive wall. However, this attitude, this position by the Israeli government is no longer true. Despite all of Israel's high-tech systems, Hamas showed it was not deterred and launched a brazen and barbarous attack. One by one, Israel's defensive systems failed to prevent Hamas terrorists from murdering more than 1,200 Israelis and kidnapping 250 others. So we now are in a war because of this. So the it was a problem. We defended too much on a defensive position. In parallel, in line with the defensive position, Israel evacuated the towns along the northern border in order to move them out of, people out of the way of Hezbollah's missiles, which are from Iran. It's not clear when the tens of thousands of internally displaced Israeli refugees will be able at all to return to their homes in the north. We're talking about, I believe, about 250,000 people. On the night between October 13th and 14th, Iran launched over 300 cruised and ballistic missiles against Israel. 99% of them were intercepted by Israeli, American, British, and Jordanian defense systems. There's also been reported that Saudi Arabia and other countries were involved, but this is only by report. The successful response showed that the utility of the recent Middle East air defense architecture built since the signing of the Abraham Accords between Israel and a number of our neighbors. So according to media reports, that soon after the interception that took place last week, President Biden told our prime minister that the U.S. would not support an Israeli counterstrike. U.S. would not support an Israeli counterstrike. So what that means is Israel is in a touchy position right now. It must decide whether it has learned the lessons of its failed pre-October security paradigm, which is defense. If Israel accepts the demands for restraint, Iran and the proxies of Iran will be emboldened. If Israel fails to respond now, today, the capabilities of Iran and its proxies will continue to grow more sophisticated and also precise as time goes by. If the United States prevents Israel from launching a counterstrike now, the entire world, including China and the Middle East and Russia, will conclude that the price for carrying out a massive attack against a U.S. ally is limited if Israel does not respond now. Now, the likely success of an Israeli counterattack and the ability to limit its fallout, it will be greatly impacted by the degree to which the United States stands behind Israel. Or more importantly, Jerusalem needs assurances that Washington will provide it with the armaments it requires. American support of Israel against Iran and Hezbollah will send a clear message to the Islamic Republic of Iran that the United States and Israel stand together. A U.S.-Israel show of unity and determination would lead Iran to limit its response. Remember, it must be remembered, that the truth of the matter is that the Iranian economy is in very bad condition. It has increased reliance on energy sales to China and weapon sales to Russia. The regime in Tehran faces opposition at home. Iran is therefore much more vulnerable to a strike by Israel targeting Iran's strategic assets. It's interesting. President Biden warned Iran before it launched an attack with one word, don't. But Iran did. Now is the time to turn words into action. Right now, Israel must demonstrate that it has learned the lessons and will no longer make do with just defense. Israel must go on the offense. The United States must show its repeated assurances of support for Israel, include the Jewish state's ability not just to defend itself, but also to strike those who threaten Israel. In other words, now is a time for Israel not to just be defensive, but it must go on the offense. Israel must respond. Apparently, from the information available, Israel has advanced F-35 stealth jets that are able to penetrate deep into Iranian territory and target key nuclear sites. That's a serious thing. Such an operation by Israel would likely involve complex navigation challenges requiring flights across hostile territories like Syria, Iraq, and even the Gulf. So Israel's response, which should come, must be very, very carefully calculated. And also, looking at it domestically, the Israeli people expect security, and the government's responsibility is to safeguard the security of the people of Israel. The potential use of all kinds of assaults and missile strikes demonstrates a multi-layered approach to defense, integrating both offensive and defensive strategies. There is no doubt that Israel must go onto the offense. That is what its people are expecting. No doubt at all that the risk of escalation is very high. Iran's air defenses and the potential for retaliation, so this is a gamble. Yet, the problem is, or the issue is, the cost of not doing anything could be even higher because Iran is continuing to develop a nuclear program. So, taking this into account, the current threats extend beyond our borders. There are global implications of what would happen if Israel reattacked, if you will, defended by offensively against Iran. Whatever Israel does, it has to be seen within a larger framework of strategic defense and geopolitical sources. Whatever Israel does, it must be interpreted not only as a response to provocation, but as a cornerstone of a comprehensive strategy aimed at maintaining regional stability for the whole area here, and at the same time, actively deterring Iran. That's very important. Our government must plan a very careful strategy. We have to protect the country. We have to uphold international norms. And by acting properly, it underscores the legitimacy of the country, the right to defend its sovereignty against threats. Right now, Iran is challenging the entire region, not just Israel. So Israel must be careful what it does relative not only to Iran, but to the other countries. Israel has to reaffirm its strategic imperatives, and it must underscore its commitment to national and regional security. Israel must respond. You have to neutralize the Iranian threat, but we have to protect our relationship with other countries. Whatever we do, our action must articulate that Israel, along with its allies, is capable of confronting and overcoming any threats to its security and its stability of the area. So it's very important now that our government act properly, take everything into account, not to shoot from the hip. There's a heavy responsibility on our government right now. I'm recording this program on Tuesday afternoon. I have to assume that the brighter heads of our government are sitting together and figure out the best way to respond, because a response must be given to what happened last week. I'll be back after the break.
Warning. Take cover. The Jewish Truth Bomb is here. The show that will explode all the false narratives and fake news. Join host Lenny Goldberg each week as he wires the news together and detonates it through biblical verses that will deliver a shockwave that will blow you away. Don't miss it. The Jewish Truth Bomb. Every Monday.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. Although I've mentioned several times that I prefer on this program to let the listeners know things that they don't see in the big headlines, this time around, because of what's happening between Israel, particularly in the world situation with Iran, I have to say a few things as I understand them about our situation right now. On April 13th, Iran conducted a really massive attack against Israel. They sent hundreds of drones towards us, as well as ballistic and cruise missiles. My son showed me some pictures the other day of what some of these missiles look like, and they're really huge. The Iranian attack came in response to Israel's targeted killing of a high-ranking officer in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And so it was a revenge attack. Iran's attack on Israel is really unprecedented in two regards. First, the number of projectiles shot at Israel were in the hundreds. That's number one. Number two, the fact is, this attack was perpetrated by Iranian forces from Iranian territory. The Islamic Republic has made sure until now to attack the Jewish state using its proxies. Essentially what it does is it leaves its hands clean, and what's happening now, but they use their proxies. 99% of the Iranian attack was stopped, intercepted. The only casualty of the Iranian attack was a 7-year-old girl, a Muslim Arab citizen of Israel. She was severely attacked. It's interesting, by the way, it reveals that the first victim of Islamic politics are Muslims themselves. Very tragic. So it appears that Israel has very successfully delivered a blow to the Iranians and to its threat on Israel. And there's very little, relatively small results here in Israel. Now, according to the newspapers and the reports, Joe Biden, the American president, told our prime minister Netanyahu, you got to win, take a win. In other words, don't respond. However, what Biden said is really a misreading of what Iran is up to. In the same conversation between Biden and Netanyahu, Biden reportedly said the U.S. would not support or assist Israel in any attacks against Iran. This is despite the fact that the missiles were intercepted all over, and thousands, if not millions, of Israeli citizens were in danger. So why is Biden telling us not to respond? According to some experts, and I read some reports, and they're very convincing. According to them, that Biden's mistake is because he analyzes Iranian policy as if it were a normal state, which is acting within a system of accepted international situations, even when breaking the rules of the current world order. In other words, Biden says that Iran is misbehaving, but it's a normal state. Now, many experts believe that this is a mistake. Why? Because Iran is not acting within the bounds of what a normal state does, give or take a little. Because the Islamic Republic of Iran's conduct is the way a terrorist organization behaves. So we're trying to understand Iranian politics. However, the perspective presented is not only neglected, particularly relevant. What characterizes a terrorist organization's strategy and tactics? What is it? In general terms, a terrorist organization is a non-state actor working to achieve its political goals by spreading terror. Terrorist organizations arise from a position of weakness, and because of this, They avoid direct military confrontation with their enemy, because if they confronted their enemy head on, they would lose. Therefore, they resort to terror. Instead, these organizations employ all kinds of violence and terror against military and civilian targets alike. By doing this, they hope to gradually erode their opponent's resolve, erode the military might, and their economic prosperity. Nowadays, one should add to this the gradual defacement of a state's reputation. In a global system in which words speak louder than actions, damaging a country's good name and international standing has become an additional influence against the country. Terrorism wants to damage, it knows it can't destroy the country it's acting against, but it wants to hurt people and damage the country's reputation. That's very important to terrorists. Looking at the way Iran is behaving through the lens of terrorism, you can understand Iran's policy much better. The Iranians are not amateurs. With Israel's excellent defense systems and with the aid of others like the American, the British, one can assume that Iran knew that most of its projectiles would not reach their targets. However, it didn't matter to them. Iran has already scored a significant win. Even before a single drone was launched, Israel's media and many Israeli citizens had been going into hysterics, analyzing and reanalyzing Iran's possible avenues of revenge, mentally preparing for war and expecting the worst. That's what's happening right now. They allowed Tehran to achieve its desired effect. What did Tehran want to do? They want to destroy the sense of security of the Israeli population. This is not an isolated effort, but part of a long-term campaign which has seen Iran build machines of terror on Israel's borders. They've attacked our ships in international waters and are reporting social media campaigns to undermine social cohesion. Acting from a perceived position of weakness, Iran has chosen to employ the tactics of terror in a long-term effort to gradually gnaw at Israel's well-being, hoping ultimately to undermine Israel's foundations and topple it. Again, they know that they can't beat us militarily. Therefore, they want to eat away at our confidence and the support of others. Now, it's really been successful what they're doing. Since October, tens of thousands of Israeli citizens have been removed from their homes because of the proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah. And of course, Hamas's attack on October 7th shattered Israeli sense of security. Nothing like this has happened since the Yom Kippur War. Globally, Israel is increasingly attacked and isolated even by its allies. There are all kinds of demonstrations in the United States against Israel. Who could have imagined that last week the people supporting terrorism, supporting Iran, supporting Hamas, could shut off the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, shut down Wall Street, New York, and shut down the center of Chicago, as well as a number of other cities. So if we understand what they're doing, if we understand Iranian policy, we can better comprehend their reasons for launching what turned out to be an ineffective attack. Because they understand, and once we understand what they're trying to do or how they're doing it, we can better understand how to defend against it. Iran's policy during the past week has enjoyed great success. Israel was frightened. The people of Israel were frightened, and the country no longer feels as secure as it used to. Most importantly, Iran appears to achieve all this while avoiding a direct confrontation with the United States. The sense of security of American allies throughout the region has suffered. Emiratis, Saudis, and Israelis now see that Iran can bomb their countries and disrupt civilian life, and the U.S. will rush to assure the Iranians that no retaliation is on the agenda. The very fact that the American president tells Israel not to respond, that's a victory for Iran. So, to counter this, to send a clear message to Iran, we in Israel must act and forcefully. And that's not enough. We have to send a clear message that states cannot employ the tactics of terror organizations with impunity. And the U.S., just as Israel, must act decisively. We are acting against a nation which is acting like a terrorist organization. And the United States has to respond because it's necessary. Now, what the Americans are doing now is pursuing a policy like Chamberlain did before the Second World War by appeasing Hitler. That's what America is doing right now. And that is not good. What Iran did requires a forceful response. And if no one else will do it, Israel will have to do it alone because we have no choice. Right now, we have no idea what's going to happen. At the time I'm making this broadcast, who knows what will happen within the next several days? Because Iran's attack on Israel last week has thrust the entire Middle East and the world, perhaps, into a whole new era. For the first time, Iran struck Israel directly from its own territory. And apparently they've been developing these drones and ballistic missiles for decades. They were getting ready for years to attack Israel. Israel's security now has to be based on two foundations. One is the fact that we have to deter anyone who attacks us. We must give a robust response to Iran's attack. The second could well be a regional defense architecture. But the other nations around us, keep in mind, I've said this before, people have to remember, the nations around us are Muslim nations, but they're Sunni Muslims. Iran is Muslim, but is a Shiite Muslim nation. And the Sunnis and the Shiites don't particularly care for each other. So these Sunni neighbors of ours could be tremendous colleagues and allies in fighting against Shiite Iran. So we have to build essentially a regional architecture. Israel must carefully weigh its response to Iran, ensuring that it doesn't undermine the cooperation started already. For the last 4 or 5 years, Israel has been making treaties with the Sunni nations around us, except for Saudi Arabia. And I'm sure Saudi Arabia is watching very carefully what's happening. So the Middle East today is nothing like the Middle East was before last week. And it requires our government to be clever enough to do two things. Stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, very important, and make regional arrangements with the Sunni nations around us. That's the bottom line. And I hope our government is strong enough to do this. So that's the situation right now. This attack on Israel was a wake-up call to anyone who doubted that Israel is still facing an existential threat from Iran. So, in the United States, the Senate cleared a $95 billion foreign aid bill to help arm Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. But the House has voted on a bill only to aid Israel. We have to show that we're strong and are deserving of the aid because we will know how to use it. It should be irrelevant whether the aid to Israel is accompanied by allocation to other countries by the United States. Israel needs American aid and American support. These are the facts on the ground. Having said all this, I want to remind the listeners that this is the last program before the Passover Pesach holiday. So I want to take this opportunity to wish all my listeners, all the peoples, all the Jews around the world, a happy and a kosher Pesach. Hopefully we will get through the next year so that I can wish you the same greeting a year from now. Until next week, Jay Shapiro signing off.
Shalom, this is Nadia Matar from the Sovereignty Movement. At a time when there is so much disinformation, you have to know who to listen to know what really is going on in Israel. Israel News Talk Radio is the radio where you can know that what you hear is the truth.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.